study. That facility study is designed and intended to...
Is there any question that the facilities are falling apart, and studies after studies after studies have shown that?
There are some facilities that have done that. There has been no systematic study in this state, Your Honor, that has attempted to look at facilities in terms of needs assessment, growth, and their relationship to the particular wealth of the district. There's certainly anecdotal testimony with respect to, and there was some in the first record in this case, but there are also, there is a significant number of poor districts in the state that have pursued it and had good facilities. You also have the situation in which, and we're attempting to define for the first time, the practice of the districts, which is to whether or not they actually fund facilities from maintenance and operation expenses that have been withheld or budgeted for, or through the bonded indebtedness route. And we're trying to define the pervasiveness of that practice. Until you find that out, you simply cannot design a facilities component that is going to be fair in terms of allocating to those that have already made the sacrifice how to help cover their bonded indebtedness versus those that haven't had the money versus a direct grant or expenditure to help them out. You have to find out where you are. Now, in the event that a separate facility component is not created, Senate Bill 1 commands that the cost of facilities be equalized in the cost factors set forth in Tier 2 of the system. That's operationally defined. And it is set forth in both 16008B5 and 16256E5. Those are complementary statutes. The language in both is virtually the same. That's why they're put together. One defines the role of the Foundation School Fund Budget Committee. That's 16256. And 16008 defines the role of the Legislative Education Board. Now, in connection with the issue Judge Phillips asked that said, well, are they only making recommendations to the legislature? And the answer is no, they are not. They have within the power, 16.256B, the power to reserve funds in the Foundation School Fund. That means that and I'll give you a hypothetical example. What that means is that in the event that a $6 billion is reserved for next year, and the legislature sees fit to only appropriate $5 billion for education, the comptroller may still, because of the reservation of funds, only certify revenues of $14 million as available, or $14 billion as available for other governmental functions. The reservation has that power in that fund. Judge McCowan misperceived the notion of that by looking at that 3.22 of the government code, which has a significantly different function, which is simply to tell, to command the Legislative Budget Board to put the numbers in there so the legislature has some kind of idea how much the weights cost in actual dollars rather than as expressed as percentages. That's the provision of 3.22, or 322. Now, how is this...
Let me make sure I understand that, but... If the legislature appropriates less than the FSFBC fines, then it doesn't have to be, it's not necessarily going to be spent, but the comptroller must subtract that difference out of what's available for spending in other areas.
That is correct.
In other areas.
That is correct. Now let's flip the example. That is absolutely correct.
So we could run a surplus for one.
Mr. Owen,
yes.
These studies now that you list here in your column on your chart, they're all in-house studies by the education agency, are they not?
No, sir.
Are there separate committees making each study?
No, what happens is what has happened, the old system had been, they were studied by TDA staff in order to make recommendations to the State Board of Education, which in turn made recommendations to the legislature in the regular call session. Now, the current system is to have the studies under the control of the Legislative Education Board, the Legislative Budget Board, and through the hearings process, and because the Foundation School Fund Budget Committee is an administrative agency within the Administrative Procedures Act, to actually provide public testimony, public hearings, and a record, which is judicially reviewable, for the creation of the financing components.
So it's the staff of the education agency and the legislative budget board working together that make these studies?
Well, let me give you an example. The cost of education index and the adoption of that, which was just done by the Legislative Education Board, Legislative Budget Board. There was a panel of four outside experts that advised independently of the agency and of LEB staff, the Legislative Education Board, Legislative Budget Board. Staff work, some of the work was in fact done by the education agency in terms of coming up with the numbers, using the data, coming up, running statistical analysis.
But there are no outside citizen members.
The four advisory panel members were all outside citizen members. And those are the ones that dictated the research and, quite frankly, designed the formula.
Well, now, are these committees institutionalized by Senate Bill 1, that they're ongoing, continuing studies, or are they time limited?
They are time limited in that Senate Bill 1 requires the Legislative Education Board and the Legislative Budget Board to complete and make recommendations by October 1 of every even-numbered year. Now, quite frankly, because
it's ongoing from year to year.
Right, and that's why I have on this graphic that once we go through the legislative appropriation for the biennium, we repeat the cycle. Quite frankly, the interim work is going to be ongoing because the nature of these studies is that it takes a long time to do it. Now, we don't anticipate capturing the four advisory committee members are not going to be there for the rest of their life. They may well be replaced, and they'll come and go with respect to that. But those are outside citizens that are informing the process.
But the committees are institutionalized.
The committee that actually makes the recommendations, the Legislative Education Board and the Legislative Budget Board, are statutorily defined. The Foundation School Fund Budget Committee is statutorily defined in 16.256A. So those are ongoing committees. The membership of the Foundation School Fund Budget Committee is set by virtue of specific office holders, and about half the Legislative Budget Board and Legislative Education Board are defined, actually three on each side, Lieutenant Governor and the Speaker, the Chairs, and various committee members, and several discretionary members in each side, in each house. So those are ongoing committees that have pre-existed this. They have been given significant new functions. Now,
you say they pre-exist Senate Bill 1?
Yes, sir. Now,
so then Senate Bill 1 really didn't make significant changes here.
No, sir. What the most significant change is this, is that this whole group of studies, the Legislative Education Board, it was against the background in which the funding components were set by general law. The difference in the current system is those are no what they are presumptively set for the implementation period. So that's the minimum. But they are no longer set by law. That is that these by delegated authority from the legislature have the authority to change without going back and amending the statute the funding components of Chapter 16 and to make those adjustments based upon not how much money's left over. They read your opinion, believe me, in terms of if funds are left over basis, and created a front-loaded, prior to the legislative session starting, research-based provision for defining the elements of cost in the school finances.
You described that as the most significant change that was made in response to our opinion.
That is absolutely the most significant change in response to your opinion. Now, in addition to that, the other major components were the 70-cent tax rate. We have gone from a 33% local fund assignment to a 41% and then to a 70-cent tax rate. They have also increased the second tier significantly. And by the way, the $2,128 figure is the accountable cost number. That they took the second year. Actually, it was $2,100. The $28 was for counselors that they costed out high school counselors that they were going to put in the bill, but they didn't. So that's where they got the number. It was, in fact, based on research. Now, what happened under Senate Bill 1 is demonstrated by this chart. And those are, that's in the appendix to the brief. And these are the exhibits that Judge McCowan found were accurate, but he questioned the assumptions upon which they were made. Let me step back a second.
They were accurate based on perhaps inaccurate assumptions.
Well, we're not sure. We're not sure. Well, he didn't give us any hint about which assumptions that he did. Now, let's go back. This is House Bill 72. And what the legislature interpreted, now this is not the year upon which you decided it. This is the 88-89 school year. What the legislature interpreted from your opinion was that local unequalized enrichment was not per se abolished. It is that it was because of the pervasive nature of local unequalized enrichment that led to the inefficiencies in the system. That some local unequalized enrichment was tolerable so long as it was not pervasive. And quite frankly, any other system is going to lead to one of two things. If you hold otherwise, there are two and only two options. One is to cap it, and two is to do recapture, which is in essence a cap, but then we have the Love versus City of Dallas problem.
Well, there's no language in the prior opinion about so long as it's not pervasive. Doesn't it say solely related to tax effort?
Right. And what that was read by is back to, and we put it in our brief, was back to the debates between Mr. Justice Bonte and Mr. Justice Hightower at the Constitutional Convention in 1974, in which that same debate took place. And very similar language emerged. And it was understood at the time to say that some local enrichment, purely local, no state match, would be tolerable so long as you had an efficient system. That's how they read that. Now, that sentence is somewhat confusing, to be sure. But the legislature read that thing as saying, yeah, there will be some local unequalized enrichment. Now, if you meant something different than that, then you need to say it, because that was not understood the way that you have interpreted
it. You're saying that you advised the legislature to interpret this court's opinion of last year and the solely based on tax effort, based on some debate that two justices had in 1974?
It looks like the same argument to me, and it looks like the assertion of the same language in the opinion was very similar to the language that was in the proposed constitutional amendment that, in fact, didn't pass, but probably for other reasons. It looked very like a very similar debate. That's a confusing sentence. Make no mistake about it. To folks that are trying to be out there and in good faith try and figure out what the intent of the Supreme Court was, and when you say solely from local tax effort. And when you say that once an efficient system is reached, then local enrichment is a term of art. That means local unequalized enrichment, quite frankly. That's a term of art in the school finance business. And then you say, once you've got an efficient system, you can do this.
Now, is that defined in a statute?
No, sir. That's simply a term of art in the school finance business.
If you go to a convention of school financiers.
The legislature thought they knew what you meant when they did it. Now, like I said, if you didn't mean it, then you need to tell them. Because that's how it was interpreted.
So, Hannah, say, once you have an efficient system, do you agree with what I took as Hunter's response to be to my earlier question, that the escape of revenues which would otherwise be available to the school funding system from more wealthy districts is an inefficiency, but it is one that is necessitated by the structure of the equalization plan?
I agree with that, but I think that both you and Ms. Hunter are a bit confused about the order of magnitude of the problem. Let's look at where we are at here.
So the state did not agree with its $470 million?
No, that is not. There's taxes out there. But it is not that the rich districts are not paying any taxes. They're certainly paying taxes. They've got a tax rate in the 60 to 70 cent range. They're not taxing at $1.18 under the system. You're losing something. There's no question about it. But it's not like they're getting off free. The only way that you can get back, the only way that you can get at that additional money is essentially a statewide tax. Now, you can do it directly, But that involves Article 8, Section, it's 1E, it's not 3E. Or you can do it with a recapture provision, but we've got luck.
So what is the amount of loss?
Pardon me?
What is the amount of the loss?
The amount of loss that is calculated in terms of what they call loss to budget balance is about, in terms of, depends on how you look at it. What are you looking at, state funds?
Looking at it somewhere, what is the amount of if it's not $470 million,
it's about
is what the trial court found, what is it?
It's about $200 million.
So that loss of revenue, which would otherwise be available to the funding system, it is your position that that's simply a necessary result of the structure of this equalization plan?
Yes. I mean, any time that where you're trying to match, in some respects, the unmatchable, that is you're attempting to superimpose state taxation revenues on top of a locally raised system, that you're going to get some dysfunction in terms of the tax raising. That exists not only for school districts, that exists for every political subdivision.
The Constitution requires that superimposition to be vice versa. I mean, the state has a responsibility to make suitable provision for an efficient system. And they can use local revenues to help meet that responsibility, but they must do so in a way that meets some standard of efficiency, which is to some extent judicially reviewable. It cannot be solely to the legislature.
Now, what the legislature chose to do was to draw the line. There's two ways where you can get inequities in the system. The legislature decided that line, which is the 95th percentile, that was the point beyond which they weren't going to chase it anymore. That was the line drawn. Trial court said that the 95th percentile, that he was ambiguous on the 95th percentile, quite frankly. Now, the 95th percentile is extremely widely supported. Well, the term was coined by Dean Udoff at the law school. It was supported by two governor's committees. It was supported by the Equity Center. It was supported by virtually everybody in the legislative process.
Is it also undisputed that it excludes 124 of the wealthiest school districts and 174,182 children?
It excludes them from the equalized system. It does not exclude them from being taxed for the provision of education.
In other words, you don't consider those 124 school districts or those 174,000 children and how much is being spent on them when you proceed to define an efficient system.
When I proceed to define an efficient system in terms of measuring under the statute,
in terms of any kind of comparison with whether the educational opportunity is at all similar.
Well, yes, we do. And let's look at the district at 550. That's Alamo. Alamore ISD has got a tax base of $21 million, which for a school district isn't very big. It's out in the middle of nowhere. The reason why it's got a $21 million property value is it's got a cap plan in it. It's got two kids. That's why it has a high property wealth. And it's got incredibly high expenditures. They're spending $15,000 a kid. But that's one teacher and somebody to cut the grass, such as there is. That's it. And the air conditioner bill. There are some out there are those kids getting there? Yeah, they're getting a heck of a lot of money spent on them. Are they really getting a quality education? The answer is no. And Senate Bill 1 attempted to deal with that, by the way, for the first time, uniquely in the state of Texas, in the history of school finance. The Commissioner of Education can do away with districts like that. Now, it takes 2 years. They have to be academically unaccredited under the new statute for a period of 2 years before the commissioner can take action. He is commanded.
They have to be academically unaccredited before he can do anything to change?
Yes, sir.
A tax haven?
Yes, sir.
What does it take to become academically unaccredited?
Two kids is pretty close to it.
But there are no guidelines given.
Yeah, there are an incredible number of guidelines both in statute and in rules in terms of definition of the accreditation process. But that's a whole other aspect to the job of the education agency. A tremendous number of rules that define academically unaccredited quality of program, depth of various program offerings, things
like that. All things that were in the statute before any of this debate.
Yes, but uniquely now the commissioner, and there have been academically, well, not academically, there have been unaccredited districts, we've changed the term. There have been districts that have existed in these categories for years, but no law, for the first time, the commissioner can actually do something about it. He can annex them to adjacent districts.
Well, so really, how would you let a fire burn for 2 years before you put it out?
Well, the legislature didn't give the commissioner any authority here to do otherwise.
Now, yeah, it has to be a change in the statute in order for him to do it more quickly?
Yes. And the State Board of Education is considering a proposal to deal with that right now. But remember, when you're giving a commissioner of education a brand new power, people are going to be a little cautious about doling it out for the first time. This is giving the commissioner of education power to any distance of a political subdivision in the state. There's reasonable grounds to proceed somewhat cautiously in this area. Now, the assumptions that this chart are based upon are that every district in this state that is currently below the level of $1.18 raises their taxes to
$1.18. Your time is excluded. Are you answering Justice Hightower's question?
No, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you.
I just want to make sure I understand your position, the state's position, on the effect of Love versus City of Dallas. You still take the position as you did earlier that it's necessary for us to get to consolidation of tax bases that we have to overrule Love versus City of Dallas?
No, sir. Love versus the City of Dallas has to do with recapture. Love versus, there's kind of a Scylla and a Charybdis on this Uribe Luna plan. There's two independent. If you're going to set up countywide districts, and you're going to have a local district
for tax bases only.
Well, you can do it in two ways. You can have the district raise it and recapture if Love versus City of Dallas is overruled. Or, the distinction between a local taxation permissible under Article 7, Section 3, and this is what General Maddox ruled, he's right, the distinguishing factor between a local tax under Article 7, Section 3 and a impermissible statewide tax is the local option election. And the problem with countywide consolidation, if you're going to superimpose, we have that system under Chapter 18 of the Education Code now, but it requires a local option election. If you're going to simply create these entities and order the tax, it is a statewide tax. But if you're going to, and the problem then becomes, is if we're going to set up a system, command, if you will, local option elections, Chapter 18 elections, which the legislature can certainly do, they still have to, in order to make the Article 7, Section 3 problem, to deal with that, you've got to have the local option election. You've got to let the citizens vote to impose this new taxing authority on themselves or not. That's the other problem. There's two ways to go at it.
And that's based not on Love against City of Dallas, but your interpretation of the provision in the Constitution banning a statewide property tax.
Yeah, and historical analysis in terms of what defines a local property tax, and that is the local option election. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear rebuttal arguments from appellants.
May it please the court, I'll try to apologize my voice.